Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with another close confidant of Donald Trump who has been subpoenaed by Robert Mueller and the Southern District of New York, but is not getting the attention Michael Cohen or Omarosa are getting, even though he could provide even more damning and damaging evidence if forced to testify. Anne Louise Bardak, a Penn USA award-winning journalist, joins us to discuss her article at the New York Daily News, Donald Trump's Pecker Problem. The tabloid publisher may have more on him than Putin does. We will examine the long and close relationship Donald Trump has with David Pecker, the CEO of the tabloid empire AMI, and how, after almost destroying Arnold Schwarzenegger's political career, Pecker then threw his support behind him via the tabloids to the point where Pecker takes credit for having Arnold elected as governor of California. And the same is true of Trump, who has always been tabloid fodder. But thanks to Pecker, his opponent Hillary Clinton was Pecker's main target during the presidential election when he ran stories about her, such as sociopath Hillary Clinton's secret psych files exposed and how she had gained 103 pounds. We'll assess what it will take for Pecker to rat on Trump, given how much during their 20-year relationship they conspired on catch-and-kill stories, which are sitting unread in Pecker's favor bank. Then we'll discuss the latest eruption of child sex abuse scandal bedeviling the Catholic Church, involving 1,000 victims molested by 300 priests over 70 years in Pennsylvania, which has prompted Pope Francis to issue a letter to the 1.2 billion faithful condemning the atrocities of priestly sexual abuse and cover-up, writing, quote, "We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them." David Gibson, director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, "Will Pope Francis Take His Own Advice for Church Reform?" Then finally, we will speak with an expert on criminal law and criminal procedure, Laurie Levinson, who holds the chair in ethical advocacy at Loyola University's Law School. She served 8 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles and joins us to discuss whether President Trump tried to force a mistrial in Robert Mueller's case against Paul Manafort. We will discuss whether Trump is guilty of jury tampering since he spoke out on the first day of jury deliberation praising his former campaign manager as a good guy who was getting a raw deal. And joining us now is Anne Louise Bardak, who is a Penn USA award-winning journalist and the author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. And she has an article at the New York Daily News, Donald Trump's Pecker Problem. The tabloid publisher may have more on him than Putin does. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne Louise Bardak.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Annie. And so let's talk about Donald Trump's Pecker Problem.
Oh, dear. Well, I didn't come up with the headline, but it's certainly catching a lot of eyeballs.
I bet it is. And, of course, the fact that you've spent an awful lot of time down in Miami, Florida, has a lot to do with Pecker, right? That's his neighborhood.
Well, the tabloids and Pecker, when I first started reporting on AMI and David Pecker and these so-called catch-and-kill deals, I did it regarding what he was doing with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who also had, as I write in this piece, a very serious tabloid problem that was going to prevent him from being governor. Well, I went down, and their offices were in Del Rey. The tabloids always have loved Florida for various tax reasons. These days, they're mostly in New York City, oddly enough, in the Daily News building on 42nd Street.
So let's touch on some of the early work you did for LA Magazine and other, and Newsweek, et cetera, on the Arnold Schwarzenegger story, because it's a kind of precursor for Trump.
Right.
Schwarzenegger, they went after him, the tabloids, the National Enquirer, about a seven-year affair he had with a former child actress. And that
The child actress said that she was age 15 to 22 during that affair, they ran photographs of her in a thong bikini with Arnold, and it was just a lurid account of this very young girl and this action bodybuilder film star who wanted to be governor. And clearly the two were not going to be compatible.
So what happened to change Pecker's mind about going from trashing Arnold or exposing his infidelities to essentially, it's David Pecker himself claims that he's the guy that made Arnold Schwarzenegger governor of California.
Well, he's been known to boast that, and I must tell you, it's not entirely an idle boast. Arnold Schwarzenegger, like Donald Trump, was what you call a perennial tabloid target. These guys had so much bad behavior, so many sexploits or extramarital affairs, or just kind of boorish behavior, that the tabloids feasted on them and it made them very, very famous, which was fine if you kept it in that entertainment domain or reality TV domain, but certainly not material for a political career. And I think the last straw for Arnold was that this so-called Gigi Goyette affair with this young former child actress and the photographs, they didn't just do this lurid, detailed expose. The following issue, the Inquirer actually came out and said, why Arnold can't run for governor. And they took all the credit right there and just said about how when their piece is run, that's the end of Arnold. And they actually basically wrote a piece congratulating themselves about making Arnold Schwarzenegger political roadkill. For Arnold, if he was going to have a political career, it had to be in 2003-04 because of the recall, an unpopular governor. So he had that little window. And right in that little window, David Pecker, who had some issues with the tabloids not making money, he decided that the bodybuilding magazines were much more lucrative. And lo and behold, long story short, he convinced Arnold's longtime business partner, Joe Weider, to sell him those bodybuilding magazines. And what do you think happened overnight, along with Arnold participating? So Arnold kept the column, Ask Arnold. He was remained the cover star. So it was a deal for the Weider bodybuilding magazines along with Arnold's participation, and there was even quite a significant amount of money to Arnold to participate, which I understand he says he gave to charity. Overnight, his fortunes changed. He went from being the worst-behaved movie star in the history of Hollywood sexploits to vote for Arnold for governor, and then it even escalated to change the rules so Arnold can be eligible to run for the presidency. He'd be great in the White House. Well, none of this was lost on a guy named Donald Trump, I'm sure, who had the same tabloid problem. Every couple of weeks, there he was on the cover, Marla Maples, breaking Ivana's heart or whatever. I mean, these guys were the meat and potatoes feasting for the tabloids. And once Pecker got involved, one with the business deal with Arnold, I interviewed just about the senior staff at the time in 2003, 2004, and they just said to me, we're out of the Arnold business. It's just how great he and Maria are, how he's a great family man. And the same thing happened with Donald Trump. Trump had a big problem with specifically with the Marla Maples affair and other, you know, bad behavior. And Pecker and him, you know, at some point developed a very symbiotic affair. There were no more Donald Trump exposés. And instead, what I understand from staff there is that Trump became somebody who fed them items. I'll give you items. And it led up right into the campaign where he would actually dictate items. He was allowed to have a column. And it played a very crucial role because, remember, both these guys had just legendary extramarital problems. And when the 16, 17 women came to the L.A. Times and said, look, Arnold did these horrible things to us, if the tabloids had piled on, that would likely have been the kiss of death. Again, imagine after Access Hollywood tape, if the tabloids, remember, they're in the checkout line, they're screaming their headlines at everybody who walks by the checkout line. They're subscriptions may be way down, their news sales may be way down, but everybody, millions of people, see these screaming headlines. And suddenly it went from, you know, Donald's new squeeze to Donald for White House. And then it became just incredible attacks on anybody who was a rival to Donald Trump.
Well, particularly Hillary Clinton headlines. Hillary Clinton gains 103 pounds. Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are killing Bill Clinton. Sociopath Hillary Clinton secret psych files exposed. Those are some of the headlines. Again, I'm
Well, and even before that, you look at, it was the Inquirer who came up with this absolutely confected, insane story that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the assassination of JFK. I mean, this is just pure, sheer libel.
Right.
And Donald Trump then, so it would run in the tabloids. This is how it would work. So Pecker would put in these crazy things. And then Donald Trump would go on air somewhere on this daily TV event or tweeting about, hey, you know, big story. I'm just telling you what I read.
Right. And, without and, saying where he read it, right?
Yeah, he said, I'm just telling you what I read.
Right.
So they had this incredible synergy. Pecker would run anything in the tabloids that would be damaging to a rival or somebody who would displease Donald Trump. We can see that that doesn't take a whole lot. And lo and behold, there'd be some searing attack. Next thing you know, Donald Trump would say, I don't really know anything about this, but you can read this incredible reporting about Ted Cruz's father, you know.
Right, right.
And that went on with Hillary. What do I know? Well, they were dictating everything and working hand in glove, and eventually you get down to the specifics of what we now call catch and kill, Karen McDougal, where you see Michael Cohen arranging the cash to move to David Pecker, how they're going to put these in, I guess, a Delaware corporation. I don't know the specific details.
Right.
And you see it also, there was a doorman that made allegations saying there had been a love child for him. And, of course, as we found out with Arnold, when Arnold ran, that when that deal was made with Pecker and Weider for the company of magazines, that very time period, a very influential tabloid reporter who had previously, you know, run a lot of big Arnold pieces, he had come up with a news story about a love child of Arnold. Well, that didn't see the light of day. Nothing.
Right. And
but, of course, what did we find out years later? Yeah, of course there was a love child. He was had a baby with the maid at the very same time that his son Christopher was born. I mean, right in his own house.
Well, so maybe the former doorman at Trump Tower, who Pecker paid $30,000 to bury his claim that Trump had fathered a child out of wedlock in the late 1980s, maybe there's something to that, too. Again, I'm speaking with Annie Louise Bardak, Penn USA award-winning journalist and author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. She has an article at the New York Daily News, Donald Trump's Pecker Problem. The tabloid publisher may have more on him than Putin does. So, you know, you've got Putin out there, obviously has something over this guy, and a lot of it looks as if it's pretty salacious and incredibly ugly. And then you've got these wild cards like Michael Cohen. You've even got now the White House lawyers causing Trump heartburn. And you've got Avenatti out there pounding away at him. So elaborate on why you think this guy, Pecker, the AMI character that has all these tabloids, one, why? What did he have on him that could be more damaging than what Putin has on Trump? And two, why would he give it up if he's so close to Trump?
Mm-hmm. There's also the curious matter I mentioned in the Daily News piece that suddenly this tabloid publisher, who's, you know, a Bronx-born, you know, he's a former accountant. He's invited to the White House, and he's with a French businessman who is known as a go-between with the Saudis. Next thing you know is Pecker directs AMI to put out a glossy, fluffy, really piece of propaganda about how great the crown prince of Saudi Arabia is, just perfectly timed for Trump's visit and the Saudi prince, you know, as if we're talking about a Nobel Prize Peace winner, that kind of laudatory gloss. Somebody told me they printed 250,000 copies. God knows whoever got one. But and the next thing you know is he's buying from Bauer Publishing, I think, a 13 magazine. Somebody's giving him $80 million. Well, AMI has a history of having bankruptcies. Keith Kelly in the New York Post has written some terrific stories about the history of the bankruptcies. And so suddenly there's $80 million to buy 13 new magazines. There's a visit in the Oval Office with Trump and this Saudi liaison. I mean, all these things are happening that never in the history of the tabloids ever happened with the White House. So you got to look at it that way.
Sure, but Annie, why then, given what you just said, why would Pecker turn on Trump and reveal all of the catch-and-kill stuff that he has on him?
Well, that's a really good question, Ian, and I think one has to look at this a little bit of there's no honor among certain types of people. I mean, I won't say the disparaging word, but I think it's at some point it's every man for themselves. One of Trump's issues, and I think we see that this week with Don McGahn and what we found out about the, you know, the amount of material he gave to the special counsel, is that people don't trust Donald Trump. They don't think he will be loyal to them. Well, I have something to add to that. When I interviewed all these AMI staffers, they say the same thing about David Pecker. They say very similar behavior, hot and cold, very bad temper, and again, there's not any deep bench of loyalty to either man. And I think you have to assume that it's going to be every man for himself. And unless he's convinced there's going to be a pardon, which is possible, David Pecker is going to look after David Pecker. And remember, it's not just David Pecker. Other officers of AMI, I have been told, have been subpoenaed. Their documents have been subpoenaed. Remember, Pecker and Trump know each other since 2000. So that's 18 years or so. After they strike up this relationship, there's no more nasty articles about the sexploits of Donald Trump. David Pecker is invited to be a member of Mar-a-Lago. One of the tabloid editors was saying to me, oh, he was just a giddy kid. He waited a full day to hitch a ride on the Trump plane, even though it delayed all his business. He was dancing on the moon, they said, when he got invited to the Melania wedding. So there's two issues here. One is power, importance, business deals, acquisitions, but everybody I ever interviewed about David Pecker, including himself, and I've interviewed him multiple times, it's clear he's very celebrity-obsessed. When he talked about Arnold, he says, oh, he's my partner. I mean, he just glows when he mentions an important name. You know, it's almost like a fan sign. Mm-hmm. So there's a second element. But I think push comes to shove. I think we already can see it. There's been very good reporting in the Daily Beast about from Lachlan McCary about how somebody in AMI, somebody is trying to scrub the Wikipedia page of David Pecker and AMI about their connections with Trump, the catch and kills. there's a very interesting backstory about he suddenly seems to be very quiet. Daily Beast reported attempts at scrubbing public information of the level of contact and the depth of the relationship between Trump and Pecker and AMI. I think it's going to be very tricky. AMI, of course, released a statement saying, you know, we don't hold back anything. So that's their statement for the record. No one knows what happened with all these articles, but none of them ran. After the deal with Arnold, after he's in Mar-a-Lago, there's never again an Arnold or a Donald Trump piece.
But just in the last minute, though, Annie, mm-hmm. let's tie it into Mueller has subpoenaed AMI and Pecker, as has the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. So mm-hmm. what kind of jeopardy do you think he is from those subpoenas?
I think it's considerable. You could, first of all, the relationship is almost 20 years between the two men. They could pull up every cell phone, every email. It's not just Michael Cohen as the conduit. It's other cases peripheral to Trump. There would be the instigation of all these negative stories against rivals that were known to be untrue. I think there will be people at AMI who have various axes to grind or grudges with David Pecker. I think they will be putting him in a kind of a tough spot. Now, what most people don't understand is the U.S. Attorney's Office is part of the Justice Department Federal Judiciary, which means anything that comes down from Mueller or U.S. Attorney could be pardonable. What's been really remarkable is that the Trump appointment of Berman to run U.S. Attorney, who was a big Trump supporter, has been very aggressive. I mean, he went after the New York congressman on that alleged insider trading deal.
And Michael Cohen.
The issue to focus on, I believe, that a lot of people are overlooking is the attorney general's race in New York City. A woman named Letitia James has been pushed by Cuomo, another law professor named Zephyr Teachout,
who the New York Times endorsed her in Monday's New York Times editorial. So
Zephyr Teachout.
So
she's extremely capable, and they have made no bones about they are campaigning on investigating all the alleged Trump funny business that could have happened in New York City. And, of course, Trump headquarters are New York City. Trump Tower is on Fifth Avenue. And that is where no pardon could touch you.
Well, Annie, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it. And stay tuned and do a follow-up, please.
You bet.
Okay.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Anne Louise Bardak, who's a Penn USA award-winning journalist and author of Cuba Confidential and Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. She has an article at the New York Daily News, Donald Trump's Pecker Problem. The tabloid publisher may have more on him than Putin does.
And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back discussing the latest eruption of child sex abuse scandal bedeviling the Catholic Church.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, whoa, closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear.
That's me in the corner.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Gibson, Director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University, and an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker who specializes in covering the Catholic Church. He is the co-author of Finding Jesus, Faith, Fact, Forgery, which was made into a TV series on CNN. And he has an article at the New York Times, Will Pope Francis Take His Own Advice for Church Reform? Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gibson.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And the Pope, I think it's the first time actually a Pope has done this. He wrote a letter in response to the latest revelation from a grand jury in Pennsylvania of widespread sexual abuse of minors, 1,000 minors abused by more than 300 priests in a period over 70 years. And it would seem to me that the church has, particularly over the past two decades, since we seem to be keep going back to this story, you know, it's like Groundhog Day in a way, that they've resisted acknowledging the scale of the crisis. So let's start with the scale of this. If you have 300 priests, that seems like an awful lot. Do you know what percentage that would be of, I know it's over a period of 70 years, but do we have any idea of the scale of this problem within the ranks of the clergy itself?
Yeah, we do. And it is so many. As they say, one case is too many, and just one case is a tragedy. And when you're talking about 1,000, at least, victims, I mean, these are the ones they have files on. These are the ones who've come forward. It could be higher. But you also have to put it in context in the sense that, you know, Pennsylvania is a very Catholic state, 25% Catholic, millions of Catholics, and you're talking about thousands of priests over this span. So, but it still amounts to 6-8% of the clergy, which is extremely high. In past surveys and past revelations, you've seen anywhere from 3-5 or 6% of clerics involved. So, you know, you put it in context, it falls in line with other organizations, teachers, Boy Scouts, that kind of thing. But what is the context here? I mean, this is, you know, at a certain point when you're talking about abuse, it's kind of irrelevant. You want to go to, A, the tragedy of the victims, and this happened a long time ago, but you also want to go to the question of institutional credibility, and finally, what needs to be done, what can be done so this doesn't happen again.
So in the Pope's letter, where he talks to condemn the atrocities of priestly sexual abuse and the cover-ups that followed, and that he asked lay Catholics to join him in uprooting this culture of death. And just to quote a little bit of his letter, with shame and repentance we acknowledge as an ecclesiastical community that we were not where we should have been, that we did not act in a timely manner, realizing the magnitude of the gravity of the damage done to so many lives. We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them. Of course, some people feel that it may not be too little, but it's a little too late. How do you see the Pope's reaction?
Well, I think it's a very powerful letter if you read it, and it's, you know, I think it's a very good start. I think it's important to realize, again, Pope Francis has been there for just 5 years, and in a way, this, again, these cases not only go back 70 years, there are hardly any in the last 20 years. That's not the point. That's not to say the matter, the problem has gone away. There needed to be this exposure, this purification of memory. These things needed to be brought to light, the names of the abusers, so that victims would feel that they'd at least had some, you know, recognition of what happened to them. So, you know, in a sense, this got, you know, dumped on Pope Francis's desk. But he also, and this letter is very powerful, but you need concrete steps to follow up on that. That's what people are looking for. I mean, you know, for Pope Francis, it's fairly new. For everybody else in the U.S. Church and in the United States, you know, I've been covering this for 30 years, since the 1990s, when we were told, oh, this isn't an issue, it's less than 1% of the priesthood, when we were told the media was the enemy you're trying to bring down the church. So, you know, and I'm Catholic. I mean, for those of us, you know, who've been living with this and covering this for so long, it's not new. And that's why I think the sense of outrage is so pervasive. It's not just, you know, liberal Catholics or just, you know, folks in the pews, just regular church-going Catholics who are outraged. Now, the right wing, the conservatives in the church who often defended past popes and defended the church and defended the hierarchy, they're outraged as well. So it's new, that level of outrage, and this is a good letter, but the Pope needs to follow it up. He needs to follow up on his own very strong words against this kind of clerical culture, which is really at the heart of the scandal.
But earlier this year, of course, Pope Francis had something of a crisis on his hand when he defended a Chilean bishop accused of covering up for a very notorious and scandalous priest. Then the Pope had to reverse himself. So after this Pennsylvania revelation, I imagine he is pretty rattled.
Yeah, I think that's a good read. I mean, I think there is, you know, he's very much wanted to reform the church, to open up the church, especially to not make it. He's been powerfully, you know, throughout his papacy and even before he became pope, this idea of this elitist clique of holy men, of priests and bishops and cardinals kind of running things and, the you know, covering for each other, he was against. But, you know, he's had an up-and-down record as pope, and this most recent thing earlier this year when he, you know, took the advice of the Chilean bishops themselves, said, hey, they had no problem. Then he was shown evidence, you know, that, look, this is a rot from top to bottom in the church in Chile with this abuse. And to his credit, he wrote a very heartfelt letter of apology, said, look, I was dead wrong. And the entire hierarchy in Chile submitted their resignations, something, you know, some people would like the U.S. bishops to do. So there's been kind of a, you know, a learning curve for him, and I think that's a positive thing. I think you want somebody who has been rattled by this, as we have been rattled by this. And again, hopefully that progresses to some next concrete steps.
So in your article at the New York Times, David Gibson, Will Pope Francis Take His Own Advice for Church Reform? You talk about how the Pope has been very critical of what he calls careerists and airport bishops who spend more time flying around the world than tending to their flocks. And then, and this is what I want to focus in on, clericalism is a perversion of the church. Pope Francis told 70,000 young Italian Catholics at a rally this month, the church without testimony is only smoke. So tell us about what he's talking about in terms of clericalism.
Well, clericalism really, you know, in a shortly defined, is basically the old boys network. And again, it's an all-male priesthood, so it is all boys. And it's that idea that you've got this you know, divine set of men, the divinely ordained set of men with who are set apart and above everyone else in the church. And, you know, that it kind of creates this sort of cliquishness, this elitism where, you know, the sins of your own are covered up or that you're running things, et cetera. And he just really detests that. He thinks that, you know, everyone is in the church and that everyone should have a say in the church and everyone should be consulted. And I think this is something that, you know, it's about the sexual abuse crisis. Again, this is about priests abusing children, but that's not as much what enrages people as the fact of cover-ups and shuffling around priests that enabled a priest not to just abuse one child, but a priest to abuse a dozen children. So it goes to an entire culture. It goes to an entire ecclesiology, an entire theology of the church that has to be rethought. And that starts with rethinking seminary education, how priests are trained, how isolated they are from the real world, and how prepared they are, you know, with their sexual maturity to deal with the vow of celibacy, for example. So there are a lot of moving parts here that feed into this culture of clericalism that needs to be vanquished.
But some critics who were watching the pulpits on Sunday in Pennsylvania said that a lot of the priests and bishops did address it. Others were sort of mealy-mouthed, and or others sort of wrapped it up in sort of ecclesiastical gobbledygook. Some outright didn't even mention it. So what kind of reviews would you give the acknowledgement so far within the American Catholic Church about what happened in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think there have been a lot of, from various bishops around the country, there have been a lot of powerful statements, some of them calling for some unprecedented steps, you know, lay people supervising bishops, investigating bishops, you know, to see if they're doing the right thing or not, more lay people involved in the selection of bishops, not just leaving it to the Pope. There have been some good things, but again, it's been a sort of an up and down response. The bishops will be gathering in their annual meeting in November, where they're expected to address this thing and talk about some concrete steps. So we'll really see then what's going to happen. But again, you know, it's a hierarchical church, and that means it all lands at the doorstep of the Pope, in this case Francis. And the bishops don't really have the power or authority to govern themselves, to be watchdogs on themselves. So they need the Pope to either set up or to okay some really, some mechanisms. But, you know, again, it varies from pulpit to pulpit and parish to parish in terms of the response of the pastors and the bishops, and also the interest and concern of lay Catholics. You know, it's a scandalous thing. A lot of us are tired of this, but there are also people who still love their church, and they love their parish, and they love their priest. And this is something that's a scandal that is somewhat removed from them. But in the end, it affects us all.
So when you mentioned a minute ago, David Gibson, how priests deal with celibacy, is that in itself a problem? I mean, is there any talk within the church of allowing priests to marry, ordaining women? Is this just too much to ask for? In other words, a life of celibacy? Because there clearly has to be a connection there between the fact that so many of these priests have failed in terms of their vow of celibacy.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I'm hesitant to place the blame entirely at the door of celibacy. I think they're not trained or educated to deal with celibacy. But again, you know, the bulk of abuse by far, the vast majority, is by married men who are, you know, abused children. So it's not that, but it is a contributing factor. If you're not prepared for this life. And also it contributes again to that clericalism where we're a caste of men set apart, and there's a kind of, you know, everybody's, each one has each other's back. The idea of, I'm a supporter of optional celibacy, and I think Pope Francis has also said, look, that's something we can certainly do. That's not divinely ordained. That's just church law, and in fact, he's convening some meetings to discuss that. I think what's important for the priesthood is to have a diversity of voices in there. Married men, they're talking about ordaining women as deacons. It's not ordaining them as priests, which seems to be off the table. Having more women ministers and deacons in there. Having more different voices in the conversation. Having more lay people in real exercising authority in the church. That's the kind of thing that would, I think, break up this kind of culture of secrecy and provide some accountability and better safeguards.
Well, David Gibson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Been great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Gibson, who's director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University and an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker who specializes in covering the Catholic Church. He's the co-author of Finding Jesus, Faith, Fact, Forgery, which was made into a TV series on CNN. And he has an article in the New York Times, Will Pope Francis Take His Own Advice for Church Reform? And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back discussing whether President Trump tried to force a mistrial in Robert Mueller's case against Paul Manafort and is guilty of jury tampering.
church is filled with losers, psycho or confused. I just want to hold the div.
What a crime! In the old time, in the old time, in the old time, it was not a crime! Not a crime! Not a crime!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Laurie Levinson, who holds the David W. Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant United States attorney in Los Angeles, and she's written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Levinson.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us, Laurie. And do you think that Donald Trump, in making this statement on the first day of jury deliberation in Robert Mueller's first big trial against Paul Manafort, Donald Trump said to the media from the lawn of the White House, "I think the whole Manafort trial is very sad. I think it is a very sad day for our country. He happens to be a very good person, and I think it's very sad what they've done to Paul Manafort." Does that rise to jury tampering?
I don't think it was appropriate by the president, but I don't think it probably rises to the level of legal jury tampering, in part because, frankly, we've had other presidents or political leaders who have made comments about ongoing cases. Again, not appropriate, but it happens. And second, because the judge has instructed these jurors not to pay attention to what's in the media, even if it's said by President Trump. So it does seem to be a type of manipulation, but hopefully the jurors have said that's not what we're going to decide this case on.
But previous presidents like Nixon weighed in on the Charles Manson case, saying Manson was guilty. That was hardly a newsflash. This is a case that directly involves Donald Trump, surely. This is his campaign manager, and it could lead unraveling more about his legal jeopardy.
I think that's right. I think he has a tremendous self-interest in the case, and actually it's just highlighted by these types of remarks. But I don't think that his actual impact on the jury is something that's going to be easy to prove. And, you know, again, in what he said, this is sad. I think he's a good man. It comes shy of saying, and it would be inappropriate or illegal or against justice for you to convict him. He wants to send a message without taking the responsibility of really impacting the jury.
So is there a legal distinction between jury tampering and trying to influence the jury?
In some ways there are. We really reserve jury tampering for cases where people have direct contact with jurors. We've had cases in the past where jurors have had things mailed to them. The judges have said that's not enough for jury tampering. Jury tampering is that one-on-one contact directly, not things that are filtering through the news that may impact the jury.
Well, on the first day of the Manafort trial, Donald Trump did speak out. He tweeted out that Manafort was being treated worse than Al Capone. And, of course, I don't think Donald Trump was aware of the irony of that, since Al Capone was charged with tax evasion, which is largely what Mueller is prosecuting Manafort for. So this wasn't the first time, by the way, that he spoke out.
No, I mean, basically, you know, people just sort of roll their eyes and say that's Trump. It's hyperbole. It's something that the court has the duty to protect against, whether it be in screening the jurors, who they're listening to, whether they're following those types of tweets, reminding the jurors that should not enter into their decision making. But in the end, it's something that often prosecutors just have to deal with, and it's not an easy situation. I think we're seeing that prove true in this case, where the deliberations are going on longer than I'm sure that Mr. Mueller is comfortable with.
And again, I'm speaking with Laurie Levinson, who holds the David W. Bertram Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. And prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles, and she's written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. And it's in this case, though, the judge, T.S. Ellis, chose not to sequester the jury, even though he himself apparently has been personally threatened and is under the protection of U.S. marshals. So is that unusual?
Well, it's not unusual not to sequester jurors anymore. We used to do it much more, but we frankly can't afford it now. It's extremely expensive. So we operate under this myth that the jurors are just not going to pay attention. I think the last time we saw a major case sequestered was the OJ case, and people still question that. The issue is whether we can have fair trials where jurors do their duty and they're not influenced by political figures or anyone else. This is being called into question, but in some ways, it's some of the remarks that were going on inside the courtroom, even by the judge himself, that could have a greater impact than even what was being said on Twitter.
Well, when the judge really went after the prosecutors, I think on a couple of occasions, and he had to be corrected, but the prosecution doesn't get an appeal, do they?
That's right. I mean, that's why it's so damaging. You know, the judge's control of the courtroom and the judge maintaining a neutrality is really key to the case because jurors, in my experience, want to please. And so maybe there are jurors out there who want to please Trump, but it's more likely that there are jurors who are looking for cues from the judge. So when the judge says you can't prosecute somebody because they wear fancy suits or they're rich, that in many ways did undercut the prosecution's case here. And even though the judge took some of it back, the lingering impact of that is something we won't know. If the prosecutors lose, they don't get a second chance. This may end up being a mistrial, and they can learn from that and how they present the case the next time. And the judge can learn from it in terms of how he reacts to the evidence.
But it only takes one juror for a mistrial, right?
It does. They have to have a unanimous verdict in order to have a verdict in this case, whether it be a conviction or acquittal. So for a three-day deliberation with multiple meetings between the judge and the parties, it looks like something is hanging this up from being unanimous either direction.
Well, let's do the math. Donald Trump has something, 30 to 40% support in the country. So whatever that percentage is, let's divide that by 12 with the 12 jurors. It's not unlikely that one or two of those jurors are Trump supporters.
Well, no, it's not unlikely at all. And that would have to be one of the biggest concerns the prosecutors had from day one, although it is unlikely in that jurisdiction, which I think is a jurisdiction that was not known as a heavily Trump-supported area. But as you pointed out, it only needs one person who's saying, you know, I'm going to be the hero. And it may be just in looking at the evidence. In all fairness, the jurors get to look at the evidence and decide how convinced they are. And another challenge the prosecutors had in this case is that they had to rely on somebody who was cooperating. And the defense did a very effective job about making the trial about him and not about Manafort. So this case was one that a lot of people thought was slam dunk because if you follow the money, Manafort looks really guilty. But if you focus on all these other issues, it might be enough to raise that reasonable doubt.
Well, though, I mean, it's still, if there is a mistrial and if it only takes one person and if that person turns out to be sympathetic to Trump, and if because they're not sequestered, and I can't see why they wouldn't know about what's happening in the outside world, that Trump calling Manafort a great guy and that he was getting a raw deal could have influenced the outcome. And that, to my mind, it could well have been why Trump did it. I mean, some people think it was off the cuff, that's who he is. But on the other hand, for all of the criticism that's leveled against Trump, and I'm guilty of it myself, and even his own protege has written a book calling him unhinged, he's very canny, and he's fighting in a very, gloves-off,
kind of street brawling Roy Cohn kind of way, is he not, against the law? He's like, this is a man who's one step ahead of the sheriff, and he's fighting hard.
Right. And, you know, I don't disagree with he shows tremendous disrespect for the law. He has shown that in many different ways, whether it be this case or Joe Arpaio, who he pardoned. There are so many ways that he has just thumbed his nose on what many other people in the criminal justice system say, you know, you should follow the law. You know, I'm not disregarding the fact that if there were sort of a smoking gun, or in these days a smoking tape, where Trump says, watch me, I'm going to try to impact the jury by letting loose these tweets, maybe that would be a different situation. But without that, we're sort of stuck in a situation where he has a big voice that could make its way to the jurors. And we ordinarily would trust the jurors to sort of say, he doesn't get to decide. Trump is not doing the job. But if you don't have jurors who think that way, then it can be a problem.
And in the Paul Manafort trial, what did you think of the fact that his defense lawyers did not call any witnesses for the defense? This has led to speculation that Manafort is relying on the prospect of Trump pardoning him.
Oh, I think that's certainly one possibility. I think there are a couple reasons for that. One, I think they did want to make the case about the prosecution's case and that they didn't believe that they had proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. I think every witness they called could be vulnerable and actually backfire against them. And I do think that they believe there's a safety net in this case. And the safety net is the same person out there saying, don't prosecute Paul Manafort, he's a wonderful guy. He happens to also be the president who has the power to pardon. So logically, why put on a case? It could only hurt you when you may not need it at all.
Well, Manafort's lawyers, by the way, praised Trump's statement. And could they be in any way censured for that? Aren't they officers of the court?
They're officers of the court, but they have the right, the First Amendment right, to make statements as long as there's not a substantial probability that would materially affect the decision-making. And they're going to stand by the same thing, which is to say my client is a great guy. There's nothing that the president said that isn't true, and that the prosecution is basically overzealous in bringing the case. I don't know of any, you know, state bar or disciplinary committee that would say to a defense lawyer, you don't have the right to say that on behalf of your client. They'd have to go much more into the facts to be vulnerable to some type of censure based upon that.
Well, it's pretty clear that Trump is, you mentioned, we talked about the pardoning. He's circumvented the Office of Pardon Attorney in the White House. So he's not following normal procedures. And he pardoned these Oregon ranchers who were close to the Bundys. And he also, as you mentioned, he's pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He also pardoned Dinesh D'Souza. And he's already talked about pardoning himself. One of the comments that I've heard from some of the White House reporters is that with Donald Trump, it's like he's discovering these new toys in this big playground, the ultimate reality TV casting in the world to be president of the United States. And some of the favorite toys of late he's discovered where he gets instant gratification is pardoning, tariffs, and pulling people's security clearances.
Right. I actually think it's, even though people are amused, I find it particularly frightening because it calls into question even our constitutional setup, how much power the executive branch should have. I think that when the framers put in our system, they believed that we would have an executive that would basically use those tools for the benefit of the nation, not to protect himself, even though that was a possibility. But with what President Trump's doing, it could cause what we call the constitutional crisis. It could cause, if we had a different Congress, for them to take a look and say, should he remain in office? The problem here is that we don't have any counterbalance. We don't have any other group in government sort of saying, you've gone too far. These are important questions. It worries me that when we have government or justice by tweet, because these are really serious issues.
Well, from day one, though, if you talk about pulling the security clearances, he's going after the very people who briefed him on the 6th of January 2017, just before he was inaugurated, who told him about Russian interference in no uncertain manner with great detail. And that's what's frightening, is that he seems to be – it's almost like King Canute trying to defy the tide. He's trying to defy the reality of what they've told him.
And there are a lot of questions. Why is that the case? Is he trying to protect himself? Does he just not see the reality? Is he the one person who's right when he says there wasn't Russian interference? I'm really hoping that we continue to move forward to get the answers to this. It is extremely troubling to me when he tries to invade the independence of prosecutors, especially a special counsel, because right now that's the only method we have to find out, quote, the truth. Now, I know we had some discussion this weekend about whether there is a real truth, but there are facts to be found. And I still think there's a value in finding those facts.
But could Trump extend the pulling of security clearances to Mueller himself and Mueller's investigator and their investigators, and thereby shut down the investigation?
You know, hypothetically, is that possible? It might be, but we've heard at least some members, even of the Republican Party, say that's where they will draw the line. So what you're pointing out is crucial. We think we have, quote, a legal system, but we have a legal system that is really infused with politics and ethics, and we're on a whole new game with President Trump when it comes to those issues.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, there's an interesting article by Bernadette Myler at the Stanford Law School about Trump's use and abuse of pardon power. And she says that his manner calls to mind Nazi jurist Carl Schmitt's statement that sovereign is he who decides on the exception. In other words, whoever declares that the rule of law doesn't apply at the same time announces himself as the highest power in the state. And this idea was used to justify the grant of emergency powers to the German president under Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution, enabling Hitler's rise to power. And therefore, if Trump is pardoning, using his pardon as exception, and in pardoning Manafort, he would be using it to declare himself sovereign and his associates above the law. I'm not suggesting that Trump's in any way Adolf Hitler, but there is clearly a dangerous analogy there.
I think it's one that we really have to think about. I know a lot of people say it couldn't happen here, it couldn't happen now, that's too extreme. But I do think we have to learn from history, whether it be here in the United States or in other nations. It's a problem when one person has too much power or thinks they have too much power. And, you know, whether you think that they're doing it for, you know, ignorant reasons or intentional reasons, we've seen this before. So I think a lot of the pushback against Trump is the idea that he wants too much power. He wants too much power in a lot of realms. For the president, they need a lot of power, whether they be commander-in-chief in some areas. But we do have a separation of powers, and the justice system at least is one that should be separate, and we're having the mingling of it happen right
now. Sure. Well, Laurie Levinson, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, Laurie Levinson is holds the Berkham Chair of Ethical Advocacy at Loyola University. And I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.